around the world, hacking into phones of thousands of activists and journalists in many different countries. It was claimed by the organization that it had no access to the information its spyware was hacking for other regimes. However, that would fail to explain how NSO advisory board member Sherry Blair was able to inform the ex-wife of Dubai's ruler that she was a target of her former husband. If the NSO group does not have access to this information, how could Sherry Blair possibly know? The shocking Zionist police attack on the funeral of Shirin Abu Akleh reminds us that none of this behavior is new to Zionist occupation forces. Apartheid troops shot dead Shawkat Khalil Awad at the funeral of Muhammad al-Alama, a child they shot dead the night before in 2021. And there have been many other examples of Palestinian funerals coming under violent assault. So here we have a pariah regime, rejected by much of the world, which engages in constant covert and overt war against any journalist seeking to reveal the truth about its actions. Long live the martyr, Shirin Abu Akleh. Long live adversarial journalism.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Mona Kandil. Mona is a Ramallah correspondent for Press TV. Being a journalist in occupied Palestine is not easy, and many times Mona's had to remove her Press TV logo from her mic while covering demonstrations and clashes in Al-Quds. The most difficult is the protests ending up with confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters. The challenge for her, then, is to cover a story and return home safe and sound. Mona was born in Lebanon and grew up in Saida City. She also lived in Algeria and Syria before returning to Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Mona joins us today from Ramallah. Welcome to the show. Mona, I wonder if we could get you up on the screen, if we could perhaps start with you, if I may. I mean, the situation in the West Bank since Shireen's murder, I mean, we've seen, you know, many outrages in recent weeks. I wonder if you could give us a feel about the situation and what the atmosphere is actually like there right now.
Well, we have to say that Israeli aggression, Israeli violence against the Palestinians have been escalating even, let's say, with the start of the holy month of Ramadan, and mainly on Fridays of the holy month of Ramadan. However, when Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was murdered by Israeli soldiers in cold blood in Jenin, as everyone watched her killing in Jenin last week, since then, and the Israeli soldiers had been really outraged. On the one hand, they killed a Palestinian journalist on cold blood, and on the other hand, they don't want for the Palestinians to confront the Israelis, to express their anger, to demand for bringing the Israeli soldiers who were behind the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh and to prosecute them. This is very weird for the whole world. First of all, Israeli soldiers in Jenin killed Shirin Abu Akleh while she was wearing her flak jacket. It was clearly written on its breast. And she was also putting her helmet as well. Before her death, another Palestinian journalist, Ali Samoudi, was shot and wounded. And he tried to warn the other journalists there, Shirin Abu Akleh, and another female journalist, Shada, in order to take care. But however, they couldn't. They tried to shelter themselves, to return back to a wall that was next to a tree. They were close to the Israeli soldiers, but at the same time, there were no Palestinian protesters, no Palestinian fighters, no Palestinian citizens around them. So there were only a group of journalists, Palestinian cameramen, trying to shoot the Israeli Israeli military incursion to Jenin, and then there were the Israeli soldiers opening their fire towards those Palestinian journalists, Israeli soldiers, of course. Everyone also saw when a Palestinian man tried to pull the body of Shirin Abu Akleh. Israeli soldiers didn't stop. They continued to fire towards those Palestinian journalists. So it's a murder. It's an assassination. we're not saying the Israeli soldiers' acts and aggression and crimes are saying that it's an assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh. The escalation continued because it was a shock, not only for Palestinian journalists. We have to mention that Shireen Abu Akleh is a well-known Palestinian journalist because she works with an Arab channel that, let's say, the Arab people here in Palestine follow, of course, the Arab channels, not the English channels, let's say. And she was working for Al Jazeera for over 20 years. She covered the Israeli, the Intifada. She covered the Israeli refugee almost 20 years ago. So many of them considered that by killing Shireen Abu Akleh, the Israeli forces had killed a sister of every Palestinian, also killed a friend of their childhood. This is why it was very difficult on them. And this continued to anger the Israeli military, of course.
Yeah. I mean, David, the scenes from Jenin, I mean, absolutely shocking. And, you know, the monstrous attack on the mourners at Shireen's funeral, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that. I mean, what's your take on the situation?
Well, I mean, it looks like that the Israelis simply cannot tolerate any sign of resistance. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they objected to, it appears, in the funeral, was the appearance of Palestinian flags. And they had said in advance, you can't have Palestinian flags, you can't have chanting. And then, of course, when they attacked the funeral, they said later, well, it was because there were stones being thrown and there were rioters, and we attacked the rioters. Well, no, the people were the pallbearers they attacked. They weren't rioting, they weren't throwing stones. The footage clearly shows that. What they can't stand is any sign of resistance, of a proud, resistant people. And the Palestinian flags is one of those signs. And you see footage across the West Bank of them trying to remove Palestinian flags from demonstrators, etc., because they can't bear the sign of resistance. I think it betrays, though, a certain insecurity amongst Zionist forces themselves, the police, the military, and also the settlers, a certain insecurity which has been expressed even by the defence minister, Benny Gantz, the other day, when he said, you know, it's not very clear that we can still be here in a few years' time. We might have to constrict the state of Israel to a small portion in the middle around about Tel Aviv. Mm. So they are worried, and that's what leads to the ultra-violent expressions against Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral and indeed other incidents.
Yeah. Mona, how on earth do journalists operate in such an oppressive environment as that?
Well, let's say the most important thing is that to tell the truth, to cover the Israeli crimes, but also to try to return home safe and sound. And this is not difficult and not easy for Palestinians, of course, because the Israeli soldiers do not differentiate between Palestinian journalists or Palestinian protesters. All of them are considered Palestinians. It's not the first incident when a Palestinian journalist is killed. 50 Palestinian journalists have been shot dead by the Israeli forces since 2000 up till the moment. The number of Palestinian journalists have been detained by the Israeli forces. Also, expressing your thoughts over social media, of course, is prohibited. You would be arrested and questioned by the Israeli soldiers anytime. Palestinian journalists continue to face the same destiny of the normal people here. When we covered the protests and demonstrations, numerous times we had been attacked by the Israeli soldiers, suffer suffocation due to inhaling the tear gas. Me, myself, I had to stay in hospital for almost 24 hours because of the heavy tear gas that was fired by Israeli soldiers in the last protest almost 3 years ago. It was a different of gas that caused not only suffocation, but long side effects. So the Palestinian journalists try their utmost in order to cover what's going on, but at the same time make sure that we are safe. However, the Israeli soldiers do not differentiate between the journalists and the protesters. In addition to this, working with with any channel that the Israelis consider their enemy. It's not only press TV, we have to say this. Any international channel or international TV would be considered by the Israeli regime as their enemy. They don't want for the journalists to expose their crimes, to tell the world what's really going on. They want to kill the people, arrest people, demolish Palestinians' homes, annex the lands and seize more lands, of course, expand illegal settlements. And at the same time, they don't want for anyone to expose their crimes or to tell the world and the international community, let's say, what's going on. They continue to act as a state above the law, knowing that at the end of the day, there would be no accountability. Their soldiers, of course, would be would have the impunity, and no one would drag them to the International Criminal Court.
We're going to have to just move on to the next item now, Mona, if that's OK. How the influence which is being put upon the media to actually, you know, give a distorted position in relation to the reporting and indeed what's actually happening on the ground in Palestine.
Western media try their best not to tell the truth about Palestine. The double standard on Palestine and Ukraine has been pointed out by many. The same is said about the reluctance to use active words like killed, executed or murdered for the killing of the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Al Jazeera journalists, colleagues of Shireen Abu Akleh, expressed outrage at the murderous activities of Zionist forces. Two argued that the network should no longer allow apologists for Israel to appear on the channel. Algerian journalist Khadija Ben Genna, with 2 million Twitter followers, called on Al Jazeera to boycott Israeli guests. Ahmed Mansour, host at Al Jazeera Media Network, with 1.3 million Twitter followers, added his voice, demanding that Al Jazeera Arabic stop hosting the Israeli killers on its screens or whoever represents them. This would certainly have an impact on media coverage of the conflict, especially if it was not confined to Al Jazeera's Arabic service. It's well known that Zionist propagandists are able to exert significant influence on media agendas. But who are the propagandists? And would their removal be enough to cleanse the media of propaganda for murder and war crimes? The propaganda or Hasbara apparatus of the Zionist state centrally involves the so-called IDF spokespersons unit, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and until recently, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, all coordinated by the Public Diplomacy Directorate in the Prime Minister's office. In early 2022, this effort was relaunched with a renewed commitment to funding a vast covert network of proxies and front groups. Some of this is coordinated via something called the Coalition of Hasbara Volunteers, including groups based all over the world, including many explicitly Zionist groups, as well as PR fronts like BICOM, Stand With Us or We Believe in Israel in the UK, and Camera or Honest Reporting in the US. Banning Zionist Hasbara officials and their PR and lobby front groups would help more of the truth to emerge from Palestine. But we would still have to deal with the problem of direct Zionist influence in the media. There are many thousands of journalists working in Western news organizations who are partisans of Zionism, many of them having current or former membership of Zionist organizations or Israel lobby groups. In the UK, for example, Alex Brummer is the city editor for the Daily Mail, as well as being the chair of the State of Israel-funded Abraham Initiatives. Jonathan Friedland is a senior columnist at The Guardian and was a member for the Zionist youth group Habonim Dror, as was BBC presenter Emma Barnett. There are hundreds more. The task ahead is to steadily degrade the number of Zionist assets working in the Western media, allowing independent, indeed liberation journalism, more of a chance.
David, what do you make of the suggestion that, you know, kind of removes Zionists, you know, from the news? Is that kind of a practical proposition?
Well, it sort of sounds unfeasible and unreasonable. But if you think about the flip side of this, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years when there are military conflicts, Western governments, including those of Israel and the US and the UK, have managed to almost entirely exclude those who support armed violence against the West. Terrorists, they're called. So it's not impractical for Western media to remove Zionists from spokespersons from the news. It just requires the political consensus and pressure to do so. So it's not an impossible thing to do. But it would be something which would be very difficult in the current political circumstances. The political circumstances have to change in order to do that. But I think we need to think of this as something which is part of a process of reconceptualizing what's happening in Palestine and trying to push back so that it's possible for the truth to be told.
I mean, in the previous clip, we heard about the NSO group and they're claiming that they can't get access to this sort of Pegasus information. But how is it then, do you think? I mean, maybe you could comment on that. I know it sort of mentioned it in the package there about Sherry Blair reaching out to the wife of the leader in Dubai. I mean, what do you make? It's a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, can you say a little bit about that?
Well, we have quite a number of different high-tech firms. The NSO group is only one of them. It's the most well-known because there's been the most cases about it, which come directly or indirectly from the Israeli intelligence organizations. So they are organizations which effectively have some kind of intelligence backdoor and are used as instruments of foreign policy by, for example, the Israeli state. So that this is a mechanism by which effectively a foreign intelligence agency can monitor journalists, activists all around the world and use that to their own advantage. In the case of Sherry Blair, it's odd, isn't it? I mean, the owners of this company say, we don't know what people are using our software for. We only give it to certain governments. We don't know what they're using it for. But yet, nevertheless, Sherry Blair, who had this connection with the NSO group, was able to reveal to this former royal that she was being surveilled by her ex-husband. So there's something very, very dodgy about that, isn't there? And there needs to be much more investigation of organisations like the NSO group and other similar organisations.
Yeah. Mona, perhaps we'll get Mona back on the screen again. I wonder whether you could say a little bit about, I mean, what the mechanisms that are used to ensure that Palestinian views are not heard by a global audience, you know, the truth about Palestine.
Well, it's all Palestinian journalists here do their utmost, but maybe the Israeli authorities, Israeli occupation authorities, try their utmost to tell the word that what they do would be a reaction on the Palestinian so-called terrorists. But what's going on really here in the occupied territories is that it's really a crimes and aggression being committed by the Israeli forces. It's not about only occupying a territory and that leaving them alone to live in that territory. No, Israeli aggression and violence, Israeli crimes continue to be committed. That's why Palestinian journalists are doing their utmost to tell the world what's going on. But at the end of the day, it will not be enough for them because Western, let's say, media have a role as well is to tell their people what's really going on, to tell their people that what's going on is Israeli aggression, Israeli military occupation. Palestinians are not living normal life here in the occupied territories. Palestinians are not terrorists. When a Palestinian is being killed at the checkpoints or near Israeli settlements, they have to tell the truth that in many cases, Palestinians were shot dead in cold blood just because the Israeli soldiers had been standing or near the illegal settlements or at the checkpoints, and they thought those Palestinians were suspicious for the Israeli soldiers. That's why they were killed. And then the Israelis tried to tell the world that this Palestinian or another had a knife, and they tried to attack the Israeli soldiers. So journalists have a very important role to tell the truth, to to expose the Israeli lies, of course, and to speak to the international world and to the Western countries to tell the truth that Palestinians are living under occupation and the Israelis continue to speak to the world.
I just wanted to ask David one brief question. You talked about how journalists have been incarcerated. We know that many Palestinians and journalists are routinely incarcerated. There's kind of mass incarceration. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Of course, it's shocking. It's one of the many shocking things. So, as has been said, more than 50 journalists killed in the last 20 years. And the stunning numbers of journalists in prison for incitement for things like posting on Facebook or on Twitter. And that's a mechanism which is used against Palestinian citizens in general and indeed also against journalists. And posting on Facebook support for opposition to Zionism, or indeed just poetry, which isn't consonant with Zionist views. So there's a huge attempt to try and to squelch the possibility of the expression of opposition to Zionism.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid, again, we've run out of time, sadly, so we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you very much indeed for joining us. And we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
A global index published recently ranks the United States as the world's leading perpetrator of the financial secrecy, citing the country's refusal to share key information with the tax authorities of other nations and its status as a generous tax haven for foreign oligarchs, rich executives, and other elites. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Shameful Distinction. U.S. ranked world's biggest perpetrator of financial secrecy. Here's the story. A global index published recently ranks the United States as the world's leading perpetrator of financial secrecy, citing the country's refusal to share key information with the tax authorities of other nations and its status as a generous tax haven for foreign oligarchs, rich executives, and other elites. The ranking comes despite U.S. President Joe Biden's campaign trail pledge to bring transparency to the global financial system, go after illicit tax havens, seize stolen assets, and make it more difficult for leaders who steal from their people to hide behind anonymous front companies. In December, following the leak of an enormous trove of tax documents that called additional attention to the country's secretive financial system, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen conceded, "There is a good argument that right now the best place to hide and launder ill-gotten gains is actually the United States." The latest edition of the Financial Secrecy Index, a project of the Tax Justice Network, or TJN, echoes that assessment, faulting the U.S. for its weak corporate tax disclosure rules and overall lack of transparency. In fact, the index awarded the U.S. the highest secrecy score since 2009 when the ranking began. That isn't a prize the U.S. wants to claim for itself, Gary Coleman, the executive director of Transparency International U.S., said in a statement, adding, "The combination of secrecy and size of our financial system puts the U.S. ahead of other notorious secrecy havens like the Cayman Islands and Switzerland. That's a shameful distinction." While noting that some progress has been made over the past year and a half, specifically Congress's passage of a ban on anonymous shell companies, entities often used to hide illicit cash, TJN found that the U.S. now fuels more global financial secrecy than Switzerland, Cayman, and Bermuda combined. TJN also stressed that the shell company law enacted in January 2021 is riddled with loopholes such as limited definitions of which legal entities and beneficial owners must register, 23 baked-in exemptions to registration, and an absence of requirements on all trusts. To improve on this small ranking, TJN urged the U.S. to reciprocally exchange information with other countries by adopting the Common Reporting Standard and become a party to amended Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, steps that would cut its supply of financial secrecy to world by 40%. The U.S.-based Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency FACT Coalition also outlined the number of actions the Biden administration and Congress should take, including introducing consistent anti-money laundering due diligence and reporting requirements to the $11 trillion U.S. private investment fund industry. While the U.S. has committed to being a leader in cracking down on global corruption, these rankings show how corrupt actors are weaponizing our financial system against democracy here and abroad, said Ian Gary, the FACT Coalition's executive director. The updated index comes a day before G7 finance ministers are set to meet in Bonn, Germany, to discuss aid to Ukraine and enforcement of the unprecedented Western sanctions targeting Russia, political leaders, and the broader economy. TJN argued recently that despite subversion by G7 countries, global financial secrecy has continued to shrink overall thanks to more countries adopting or improving beneficial ownership registration laws, which require the identification and registration of the real individual, made of flesh and blood, who ultimately owns, controls, or benefits from a company or legal vehicle, and by more countries, particularly lower-income countries, improving international cooperation on anti-money laundering efforts, information exchange, treaties, and judicial cooperation. Alex Cobham, TJN's chief executive, said in a statement that globally we are starting to curb the financial secrecy used by oligarchs and also by tax evaders, corrupt politicians, and organized crime against the world to hide and launder ill-gotten wealth. But the US, UK, Germany, Italy, and Japan cut back that global progress by more than half, fueling financial secrecy instead of fighting it. Command continued, adding, the G7 must take clear where they stand in the fight against financial secrecy by committing to a global asset register. TJN researcher Maureen Harari added that once again, a small club of rich countries setting global rules on finance and tax are found to be the ones most responsible for facilitating financial secrecy and tax abuses. For decades, rich G7 countries courted billionaires, oligarchs, and corporate giants with secrecy loopholes and eye-wide-shut regulations, said Harari, adding, the regulations they imposed facilitated the robbing of billions from poorer countries' public purses. And now, those same regulations are making it nearly impossible for G7 countries themselves to track down the billions held offshore by sanctioned oligarchs.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the present and future of Albania in a conversation with Albanian historian and author Olsi Yazici. But first, this brief analysis.
Albania is a small country we rarely hear about in the news. One of the reasons for this is that the US decided to turn this southern Balkan state on the Adriatic coast into a base of operations against Russia and Muslim countries such as Iran and Turkey in the early 2000s. Beyond its geographic location, it is the fact that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population adhering to Islam, that made it a target for US domination. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, the US aggressively expanded its strategic presence into Eastern Europe and the Balkans, including into Albania. Albania had been ruled by the communist dictator Enver Hoxha for decades, who proclaimed Albania to be the first officially atheist state in the world and who actively persecuted all religious activity. Despite this severe repression, Hoxha was not successful in extinguishing the religious beliefs of the Albanians, particularly the Muslim population. After the collapse of communist rule, Albanians revived religious life and re-established connections with their fellow Muslim brethren in the Muslim Ummah, particularly with Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. This caused an alarm in the United States and Europe, who feared the emergence of a majority Muslim country on the European continent with close strategic relations with the mentioned Muslim nations. A strategic campaign was initiated by the United States and its vassals to first strategically deny Albania to the Muslim world and to once again de-Islamize Albania, this time by using the excuse of fighting terrorism to ban all contacts between official Albanian Muslim organizations with any Muslim organizations from Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries. After the failure of the US-backed and Emirati-financed coup d'etat in Turkey against President Erdogan, the religious affairs of the Sunni Muslims in Albania was handed over to the pro-US and pro-Zionist Gulenist cult headquartered in the US state of Pennsylvania, a cult which played a key role in the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey. All Albanian Muslim clerics who opposed the imposition of the Gulenist cult on their country were persecuted, imprisoned, or exiled. The US also forced the Albanian government to accept the permanent encampment of the remnants of the Rajavi terrorist cult on its soil, a cult responsible for the murder of over 17,000 people in Iran since the 1970s, a terrorist cult that the Iraqi government expelled after the end of Saddam's rule because of its crimes against the Iraqi people during that era. Albania was forced to accept them after literally no other country in the world would accept them on their soil. The US strategic campaign for Albania also weaponized the legitimate feelings of Albanians and the Albanian majority population in neighboring Kosovo to turn that region into a base against Serbia and Russia. In pursuit of these strategies, the United States, through its embassy and through organizations such as the Soros Foundation, has captured and bought the Albanian political leadership, similar to the fashion it bought and captured elites in countries such as Ukraine. This puppet elite is committing the same crimes and abuses that other US-backed elites in other Muslim nations are committing, with the same result of turning the people against anyone and anything related to America. It appears the Albanian people are beginning to resist this US diktat and will eventually replace the current leadership controlled by the US with leaders who will re-establish relations with important Muslim nations in accordance with Albania's real national interests and the deep-held religious beliefs of its people.
Dr. Yazizis, thank you so much for joining us. You know, there's not many programs done on Albania. It's a relatively small country. It's one that maybe the big news organizations might not want to spend a lot of time on. It is also one of those countries which is very interestingly completely dominated by the West. A lot of stories going on there that if it was in any other country, it would be headline news. And yet we see that absolutely nothing is talked about it. And you've, of course, done a lot of interesting work on this in terms of the articles you've written and the research you've done. Also very brave of you to do this, given the situation that exists in Albania. You at the moment, are not in Albania, maybe for good reasons also. So I think what's important is that we talk about Albania and maybe just get the facts out in the first instance. To our viewers about what's really going on in Albania, which you will then lay out for us, and also then maybe spend a little time analyzing it, maybe more than just getting the information out, talking about why is it that it is the way it is, and what could be in the future. It's very interesting. You've described the leaders in Albania as our little Zelenskys, which is a very interesting but also very entertaining way of stating a fact that maybe we have an elite, we are dealing with an elite in Albania, which has been completely captured by the West and by the Americans. So if you could please, to start us off, give us a brief introduction into what's going on in Albania. What are the issues as far as you have been able to report them and talk to them about, and let us know what's going on in Albania for our viewers.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Albania is probably the oldest and the only fully recognized Muslim majority country in Europe. Albania was created as a country in 1913, after the First Balkan War, when the powers of Europe did not know what to do with the Muslims of Europe. But from the moment that Albania was created, it was an experimental state. Albania was not allowed to be a Muslim country, even though we are majority Muslim. We were cut from the rest of the Muslim Ummah. We were secularized. Islam was removed, and Albania was treated as an Italian colony until Second World War. After the Second World War, Albania became part of the Soviet Union. We were an independent country. We were a country that supported Palestine, supported the Islamic Revolution of Iran, even though the country was atheist and Stalinist. The ruler of Albania, Enver Hoxha, praised Imam Khomeini as a great revolutionary and leader of the Muslim world. And Albania played a very important role on denouncing American and Israeli imperialism in the Middle East. But what happened in Albania in 1991, with the fall of the Soviet Union, we had a regime change. And the Americans removed the communist government that we had, and they promised that they will bring democracy to us. Nevertheless, what happened after the first decade of 1990s, in 2000, when American foreign policy towards the world of Islam changed, American policies towards Albania changed as well. While in 1990s, Albania enjoyed freedom, democracy, and in a way, country was re-Islamized. Muslims, people like me, because we were not allowed to keep Muslim names during time of communism, so we discovered our Islamic roots. Countries like Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia came and helped the Muslim community to revive itself. Nevertheless, starting from the year 2000 and onwards, the Americans, and in particular the Soros Foundation, they intervened in our local democracy. We had a civil war in 96, 97 in the country. And from that moment, they brought to power the ex-communists who were socialists. Together with them, they brought Edi Rama to power, the person who now is our prime minister, who was a close friend of George Soros and the international bankers, friends of Soros. Now, after the coming of Rama to power, he came together with Fatos Nano in the year 2000, and then he came back to power in 2014. The governments that have been formed in Albania under the ruling Socialist Party of Edi Rama, they have been dominated by U.S. Embassy and Soros Foundation. So if you know Albanian politics, most ministers that we have, the evangelical and Zionist mayor of Tirana, Erion Beliai, they are all handpicked by the U.S. Embassy in Tirana, and they are byproduct of Soros Foundation. So why I call them Zelenskys? I call them Zelenskys because at the same way as the Americans and Soros and other Zionist bankers installed to power a clone like Vladimir Zelensky, the same thing the Americans have done in Albania, but not only, even in Kosovo, in Macedonia, in Montenegro, and many countries in the Balkans. So we in Eastern Europe, we don't have a democracy anymore. For somebody to elect it, to be elected as a member of parliament in Albania, but in Kosovo as well, your name have to pass through U.S. Embassy or Soros Foundation. So what has happened to us in Eastern Europe, and in particular in Albania, since the year 2000 and onward, we have undergone a massive change into our system. Number one, what the Americans have done with us in Eastern Europe, they have destroyed democracy. Number two is they destroyed the socialist economy that we had. In time of communism, we in Eastern Europe, we enjoyed free housing provided by the state, free healthcare, free education. But especially since 2014, when Edi Rama took power as a prime minister in our country, he have destroyed the social health welfare of our state. We no longer have free healthcare in the country, no longer we have a free university education, and moreover, people like our prime minister, Edi Rama, who has been a member of Soros Foundation, and his wife, Linda Rama, she has been the director-in-chief of Soros Foundation in Albania. The strategy that Americans have followed from Albania to Ukraine is debt entrapment. So what they do is they have put our countries from Ukraine to Albania into huge debts, mm-hmm. and as a result, they are increasing prices. So if, let us say, in Albania, 10 or 20 years ago, we paid for our water bill in a month probably $3 to $4. Nowadays, an average Albanian citizen pays like $20 a month. What is happening is that countries like Ukraine or Albania have been enslaved by international bankers, people whom the Soros Mafia brings along, and they use a strategy of, number one, destruction of our local economies, imposition of their puppets into power, and imposition of the policies that Soros and Washington wants people in Eastern Europe to follow.
Dr. Yazici, let's talk a little bit about some of these policies, because we know, let's give it some substance and meat in terms of what's going on there. Why don't we start, maybe if you could explain for us, how they were able to hand the entire religious, the Muslim part of the religious life in Albania to the Gulenist cult, one that was unsuccessful. They tried to do it in Turkey to make to turn Turkey into this base for this, what we would in Iran call American Islam. And they were unsuccessful in Turkey with the policies that the Erdogan government took there and the arrests that they made after the coup d'etat. But what they ended up doing is they handed Albania to the Gulenists. So if you could talk about that, and also if you could talk about, which is maybe more important for us in Iran, is how is it that the Rajavi terrorist cult, which was, you know, in Iraq and is currently also in Paris, the leadership is in Paris, but the people that were brainwashed into this cult that lived in Iraq for 40 years, how is it that they've ended up in Albania now? Why Albania?
Well, the history of Islam in Albania is complicated. During time of communism, Albania was declared an atheist state. In 1990s, when democracy came, Albanians embraced Islam again. Majority of Albanians are Sunni Muslims, but a large group of Bektashi Muslims exist. And the Bektashis, they are Shia Ithna Ashari Sufi sect. And in 1990s and in early 2000, Albanian Muslims established bridges with the Muslim Ummah, with countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and in particular Turkey and Iran. The bridges that Muslims of Albania built with the Muslim Ummah worried the Americans a lot, and in the 2000s, when Bush declared his global war on terror, which was a war on Islam, the Americans started a project in Albania to take control of the Muslim community of Albania. The Muslim community of Albania is the state institution, like in Iran you have the Seminary of Qom, which manages Islam. From 2003 to 2005, I have been advisor to the Chief Mufti of Albania, and I have witnessed firsthand how the Americans, by using the anti-terror police of our country, removed from the structures of our Sunni Muslim community the clerics who were educated in the Arab world, but even in Turkey. There was a project which the Albanian and the American government coordinated together, which aimed to give control of Islam in Albania to the Gulenist sect. The Gulenist sect were brought in Albania for a number of reasons. First, they were brought as a pilot project in order to fight the revolutionary Islam, which started to grow in Albania in early 2000. By revolutionary Islam, I mean Muslims who were sympathetic to policies of Turkey and Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East. The Americans do not want a revolutionary Islam to exist in Europe, and in particular in Albania, which is the only Muslim-majority country after Kosovo in Europe. So what they did is they brought the Gulenists in the structure of the Muslim community, And they gave to the Gulenist control over the madrasas, mm-hmm. and the only Islamic university that we have in Albania, Badr University. I have written several articles for the Yearbook of Muslims in Europe, where I analyze Islam in Albania. And the declarations that many Albanian politicians have done in years show that the U.S. Embassy instructed our leaders in early 2000 to remove, through illegal forms, the clerics from the structures of the Muslim community who were educated in Arab countries or even in Turkey. I'm talking here about the Sunni Muslims.
That's right.
And to replace them with the Gulenists. Now, when in 2016 we had the coup d'etat in Turkey against the democratically elected government of Erdogan, and from this moment onward, but even before that, Turkey was very concerned about the presence of the Gulenists. Now, I have to explain to your viewers that the present ambassador, U.S. ambassador in Albania, Yuri Kim, she was a close friend to Osman Kavala, one of the people who is jailed in Turkey, accused of organizing the coup. So, especially after 2016, Albania has become a base of the Gulenists, and the American ambassador is one of the chief persons who, in a way, coordinated the coup against democracy in Turkey. And in this moment that we're speaking, there are many protests in Albania by Muslim clerics who want to have their position in the Muslim community, but they are not allowed. The elections in our Muslim community, whenever we have, they are done under the supervision of the U.S. Embassy and anti-terror police. So clerics who are educated in Sunni countries like Malaysia, Turkey or the Arab world, they are not allowed to enter into right. this institution. So imagine if the Americans would have done this to Iran, to force a sect in Qom and to prohibit other clerics from having access.
They actually tried to do that during the Shah, but of course they were not successful. So,
yes.
So let's. So also, then, please explain to us, because we have an actual terrorist cult organization now that is in Albania. Again, for us in Iran, very important, because they killed 17,000 people in Iran, which is the Rajavi cult that used to be in Iraq. And when the Saddam regime was overthrown by the U.S., they end up in Albania. How did that happen? If you could give us a little background on them coming to Albania. And by the way, sorry, doctor, we have to also mention a lot of these people are brainwashed, because what ended up happening is a lot of them, when they got off the plane or when they were when they arrived in Albania, they actually defected. They ran away because it was the first time that they were allowed to leave that encampment that they had lived in for decades in Iraq. They weren't even allowed to leave that encampment in Iraq during the decades that they lived there. So the minute they got off the plane or the minute they entered Albania, approximately half of them, this is what the media was reporting, approximately half of them actually fled from that cult and sought asylum in different parts of Europe.
Yeah, you are correct. Rajavi cult was brought in Albania. They started to come since 2013. At first, the Americans brought them to Albania under the excuse that they had to bring only some of their leaders, but then the bulk of this cult was brought under the Obama administration, and it was the Secretary of State John Kerry who came to Albania and brought 3,000 of them. The Americans had big problem with Iraq, because Iraqis knew very well who the Rajavi cult were, and they have committed many crimes against the people of Iraq.
That's
and
right.
They were looking for a safe haven for these terrorists. They tried to send these terrorists in many countries. They approached Macedonia, Romania, probably even Ukraine, but many countries of Eastern Europe simply refused to host these terrorists. So they brought them to Albania. Now, the question that many international scholars ask is why Albania? The reason is simple. The Albanian government is a mafia government. For people who know local Albanian politics, most of our politicians, we have even government ministers, are drug dealers and who involve themselves in drug trafficking.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, the rise of multiple Make America Great Again candidates in this year's crowded primary races suggests that a new group of America First Republicans could be on the horizon. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Catherine Fung. The piece has been published by Newsweek and is titled Trumpism is moving beyond Trump, and that's good news for Ron DeSantis. In the United States, the rise of multiple Make America Great Again candidates in this year's crowded primary races suggests that a new group of America First Republicans could be on the horizon, and they won't need a blessing from the MAGA king to build their campaigns. Republican hopefuls trying to clinch their party's nomination in Ohio, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania Senate races all chased after former President Donald Trump's endorsement. But even when his coveted stamp of approval was finally doled out to his favorites, other candidates never abandoned the MAGA playbook. Donald Trump's endorsement of J.D. Vance didn't stop former state treasurer Josh Mandel, one of the other frontrunners in Ohio's GOP Senate primary, from campaigning.